Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the creation of a TIF district in Miraville for the former Star Plaza site. While on vacation in Texas, Sharon Jackson reports on the proposed border wall, Brendan Smith has a weekly statehouse update, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Ingrid Norris of the Lake County Public Library. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. Election officials in Lake County have approved a state-mandated consolidation of the county's small voting precincts. Lake County's Elections Board approved a new precinct map Tuesday that shrinks the county's precincts from 523 to 364 ahead of the May 7th municipal primary elections. The Times reports the precinct consolidations mean nearly 90,000 voters will have a new polling place. Lake County Democrats had resisted a 2017 state law requiring the county to develop a plan for consolidating precincts with fewer than 600 active voters, arguing that it would most heavily impact the county's heavily populated northern Democratic strongholds. Democrats said Secretary of State Connie Lawson's consolidation plan would disenfranchise elderly and minority residents without transportation, forcing them to travel farther to reach their polling places. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Miraville officials took the first two steps toward providing the town's portion of the public financing sought by White Lodging to help pay for its proposed $350 million mixed-use project at the former Radisson Complex site. The Redevelopment Commission and the Plan Commission on March 19th approved creating a new tax increment financing district for the 40-acre parcel at I-65 and U.S. 30. Councilwoman Roxanne LaMarca, who sits on both commissions, abstained while all other members voted in favor of the proposal, which still needs town council approval. Councilman Sean Petit spoke in favor of the TIF. Petit said a financial advisor for the town estimated a TIF district in that location would create about $6 to $7 million a year if White Lodging's proposed project, the farm at Crossroad Commons, is fully built. Petit goes on to say that money could be used for the White Lodging project or any other development if that project doesn't go through and the property is sold. Under a TIF district, property taxes collected in the designated area are frozen at a certain point and all further revenue increases are strictly used within that district, typically for infrastructure and other community improvement projects. Petit said the Miraville money could be used to pay for the proposed underground parking lot in the project, which also calls for hotels, restaurants, offices, a greenhouse, and equestrian trails, among other amenities. Miraville-based White Lodging has said it would pay 67% of the cost of its project, but hopes to secure funding from the state, town of Miraville, and Lake County Council in the form of food and beverage tax for the remainder. If the public funding doesn't come through, company officials said a scaled-down version of the project would be built. It's unknown what funding the state would provide, but Lake County officials have said they would not pass a food and beverage tax. White Lodging has said the new development would create more than 600 construction jobs and 1,000 direct and indirect jobs.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The appearance of a lot of police outside the Aldi store in Miraville was for an important reason. Two men were arrested in the parking lot on Monday because the FBI thought they were about to rob an armored truck. 23-year-old Riley Jackson Jr. of Hobart is charged with conspiracy to commit robbery, and 23-year-old Delvin Perkins of South Holland, Illinois, is charged with possession of a firearm by a felon. U.S. Attorney Thomas Kurtz said they were allegedly involved in an armored truck robbery in Illinois last summer, and they'd been under surveillance for some time. On Monday, officers saw them get in a black Jeep and drive near U.S. 30 and Broadway in Miraville. They then followed a Brinks armored car as it drove around its stops at the mall and other businesses. Police then made a stop on the vehicle, as U.S. Attorney Kirch put it, to avoid a dangerous situation. That traffic stop was in the parking lot of the Aldi store.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
A House committee took hours of testimony Wednesday on a bill that makes major changes to Indiana's gaming industry. The bill allows a Gary casino to move to a more desirable location in the city, creates a new Terre Haute casino, and legalizes sports wagering. In favor are leaders from Gary and Terre Haute. Opposed are those from communities with casinos around Gary who worry about the negative impact on revenue. The sports wagering portion of the bill has largely flown under the radar. But there is a small conflict in that area. The measure would require gaming operators to use official sports league data for in-game bets. Indianapolis Colts Chief Legal Officer Dan Emerson says that helps ensure the integrity of the bets.
Without a single resolution by way of the governing body of the particular sport, you run the risk of having conflicting results.
But Republican Representative Sean Eberhardt questions the need for that mandate. He notes sports wagering in Nevada, which has been around for decades, doesn't require it.
Do you know of any issues that they've had where the dispute has involved the lack of official sports or official league data?
The committee will vote on the bill as early as next week. A crowd of about 550 people packed St. Peter and
You're
Paul
listening
Macedonian
to Lakeshore
Banquet
Update
Hall Wednesday
with
night
D.
to hear Crown Point Mayor David Uran's State of the City Address. Uran provided a recap of the events of 2018 with an eye toward the rest of 2019. He not only recognized the city's accomplishments, he lauded the city's departments and their leaders for making it possible. The Post-Tribune reports he called the city departments and their heads, quote, one of the top working forces for any municipality out there. Uran, who is unopposed in the city's Democratic primary in May, said the city is in its best financial shape in the last decade. The mayor was proud to say that based on the assessed evaluation and the growing factor of the community, they only collect 74 cents on every $100 of every assessed evaluation compared to the average city in Northwest Indiana in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties, having an average of $1.72 on every $100 of every assessed evaluation. Uran said the city is making its final payment on the one remaining general obligation bond it has, and the payment this year of $280,000 means the property taxes for the residents of Crown Point against their homes will have no debt currently going out there for general obligation bonds. Uran said highlights for 2019 include the widening of 109th Avenue east of Broadway and the continued development of the Beacon Hill area with a $25 million bond paid for by the developer. Great grand openings in 2019 include the South Lake Family YMCA expansion, the weekend of April 12th, and the outdoor band shell and plaza at the city's new downtown Bulldog Park on May 31st. The pedestrian accessibility improvements to the downtown square will also continue in 2019.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with D. Dotson.
A Hammond police sergeant is under investigation after he was captured on audio allegedly directing homophobic and racist slurs and death threats at a man while off duty at a local bar. The Times reports that an audio recording provided to the newspaper by sources with knowledge of the investigation contains racist comments toward Hispanics and homophobic terminology attributed to Sergeant Anthony Hill. In the audio, Hill appears to allude to a past run-in with the man in which the man threatened to go to the mayor's office to report other inappropriate comments allegedly made by Hill. Later during the exchange, Hill allegedly said to the man, quote, so just go home and kill yourself. Moments later, the man reveals he was secretly recording his exchange with Hill and planned to take it to Hill's boss, presumably the chief of police. Hill could be heard on the audio cursing at the man. Lieutenant Stephen Kellogg said the department was first made aware of the incident March 7th and took immediate action to place Hill on administrative leave and to open an internal investigation. Hammond Mayor Thomas McDermott Jr. told the Times on Tuesday his administration will be calling on Hill to resign for his, quote, homophobic, racist, and reprehensible comments. The mayor said Hill's comments do not reflect in any way, shape, or form the views of the city of Hammond or the Hammond Police Department.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with D. Dotson.
Scope out the Big Dipper and the Onion Nebula in a stargazing event at the Indiana Dunes National Park this Saturday. Astronomers from several regional astronomical societies will share their telescopes at the free event from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Saturday, March 23rd at the Kimmel Beach parking lot, which is located on East State Park Road, about a mile north at U.S. Highway 12 and 3 miles east of State Road 49 in Chesterton. Those gazing on the starry night sky should be able to see the Leo galaxies, the overhead Beehive star cluster, the Big Dipper overhead, and the Onion Nebula, which is moving into the sunset. It's a monthly event and one of many ongoing programs at the Indiana Dunes National Park. More than 3 million visitors a year come to see the majestic beauty of the Indiana Dunes, where there's also a neighboring Indiana Dunes State Park. For more information, you can find the Indiana Dunes National Park online by visiting nps.gov/indu. You can call 219-395-1882 or find the Indiana Dunes National Park Facebook page.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A long-standing closure in East Chicago is set to improve water mains, sidewalks, and roadway conditions. A City News release said Homerly Avenue will be closed from 145th Street to Columbus Drive. The construction began Tuesday and will be completed by mid-October. The reconstruction work will result in the installation of new water mains and a combination sewer, the relining of the existing combination sewer, new concrete curbs, new sideways, new sidewalks, and new asphalt pavement. While Homerly Avenue will be closed to traffic, however, there will be limited access for residents. There will be no access to area driveways for 2 to 3 weeks while concrete is being placed. The news release also said no parking signs will be posted.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Teachers at an Indiana school were shot with pellet guns and injured during active shooter training. Indiana Public Broadcasting's education reporter Carter Barrett reports the group is asking lawmakers for more regulation in response.
The Indiana State Teachers Association says the incident took place at Meadow Lawn Elementary School in Monticello, Indiana, in a training administered by local law enforcement. Union leaders say teachers were brought into a room, asked to crouch down, and then shot execution style with a pellet gun. The bullets resulted in welts and blood, and teachers outside the room reported hearing screaming. ISTA Vice President Keith Gamble says the group wants lawmakers to make it illegal for any kind of gun to be used during training.
It's an unfortunate sign of the times that now active shooter training is something that school employees have to go through. So we regrettably understand the necessity, but this, to our knowledge, is the first time that any school employees have been shot at.
Twin Lakes School Corporation released a statement that says it is committed to providing a safe environment for its students and employees. The local law enforcement agency could not be reached in time for this broadcast. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
President Trump's motorcade drew crowds of residents as he made his way to Joint Systems Manufacturing Center, where Trump spoke to workers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Guiano has more.
The workers of Pedroni's Pizza were so excited the president would drive by their pizzeria on his way to Joint Systems that they made a sign welcoming Trump and asking him to stop in. Jaleesa Stevenson works at the pizzeria and is from Lima. She says she's happy with his performance thus far, and his visit was a highlight for her.
I mean, who doesn't get excited for the president to come to your hometown? I mean, it's not an everyday thing, definitely.
In a residential area of the motorcade route, Terry Morris put a sign in front of her yard reading, "Bring back honesty, Trump has to go." But even Terry was caught up in the pomp and circumstance of the presidential motorcade and says she ran outside to take a video when the president drove by.
Everybody should have a certain respect for that, even if you don't like the man in the office.
President Trump spoke to workers in Lima and then headed to Canton, Ohio for a fundraising event. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Lawmakers made it harder for Hoosiers to change their gender on their driver's license. A House panel revived gun regulation changes, and Attorney General Curtis Hill's law license is in jeopardy. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the week at the State House.
The Bureau of Motor Vehicles recently gave Hoosiers a non-binary gender option on state IDs. In response, House Republicans crafted new rules for gender changes at the BMV. Now, Hoosiers would have to get their birth certificates amended first, which requires a court order. Currently, a gender change on state IDs only requires a doctor's note. A House committee this week revived language that would allow guns to be brought into churches that are on school property. The provisions let the property owner, either the school or the church, decide whether that's allowable. The legislative language stalled at the session's halfway point over concerns about the definition of school property, which has since been simplified. And the state's Supreme Court Disciplinary Commission filed a complaint against Attorney General Curtis Hill over his alleged groping of four women last year. The commission says Hill's conduct violated the state's rules of professional conduct for attorneys. The Indiana Supreme Court will ultimately decide whether Hill will face punishment that could include suspension of his license, which would make him ineligible to continue serving as Attorney General. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Attorney General Curtis Hill's initial response to a disciplinary complaint claims the Indiana Supreme Court doesn't have grounds to punish him. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the state's disciplinary commission filed the complaint earlier this week over Hill's alleged groping of four women last year.
The Disciplinary Commission's complaint against Hill says his actions violated the state's rules of conduct for attorneys. But Hill's attorney argues battery and sexual battery, of which the attorney general is accused, have nothing to do with Hill's ability to practice law. And he says those crimes don't constitute dishonesty or a breach of trust, which are part of the attorney conduct rules. Hill's response also notes that a special prosecutor declined to bring charges last year after four women, including a state legislator, accused Hill of groping them. The Indiana Supreme Court will ultimately decide whether Hill should face punishment over the disciplinary complaint. That could include suspension of his law license, which would make him ineligible to serve as Attorney General. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Senate lawmakers gave final approval to a bill Tuesday to make Indiana's next school's chief an appointed one. Now the bill heads to Governor Eric Holcomb's desk for his signature. The General Assembly changed state law in 2017 to replace Indiana's elected superintendent of public instruction with an appointed education secretary by 2025. The move came shortly after current superintendent of public instruction Jennifer McCormick took office and left room for her to run for a second term. But McCormick announced last year she won't seek re-election, prompting lawmakers to speed up the timeline. This year's push for a change is a welcome one from Governor Holcomb. He included the bumped-up appointment timeline in his next-level agenda. After the appointment change goes into effect, Indiana joins 10 states where the governor and policymakers will appoint both the top school official and all members of the State Board of Education.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Even though federal law now allows the growing of hemp, people who make products from it say they're not getting the support they need from banks. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, a weekend conference in Indianapolis examined ways to improve e-commerce.
Those in the business of selling products that can be made from hemp, such as CBD oil, are increasingly using the internet to reach new customers all over the country. But finding a bank that will process payments and deposit money has been a challenge, as some financial institutions still view the industry as risky. Katie DeVoe has been selling CBD products for about 10 years.
And without having the big banks backing the industry, it's been such a challenge because people are having to go to overseas companies, having to pay really high interest rates in order to even have that accessible.
DeVoe says smaller banks are starting to come on board. But for the time being, she advises CBD businesses selling online to have backup payment options. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill that would let counties with overcrowded jails send level 6 felons to new regional holding facilities continues to move forward at the State House. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brosier reports, it could come with a significant cost.
Under Representative Randy Fry's bill, the Department of Correction would create regional holding facilities for level 6 felons who currently serve their sentences in county jails as a result of criminal code reform. An amendment to the bill also allows a judge to sentence level 6 felons directly to the holding centers. Fry says the state could reopen Henryville Correctional Facility and use an unoccupied wing of Madison Correctional Facility to accommodate the changes outlined in the proposal.
According to Department of Corrections, they believe that the pilot will cost about $7.5 million for the 2 years.
Fry says it's unclear where all of that funding would come from. It's now in the hands of appropriations. The Indiana Public Defender Council is against the bill because the agency says it doesn't address the problems leading to jail overcrowding. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana Senate panel has given its approval to a bill that would compensate Hoosiers found to have been wrongfully convicted and imprisoned. The Senate Corrections and Criminal Law Committee made minor revisions to the House-approved legislation Tuesday before voting in favor of the bill, which now moves to the full Senate. Indiana is one of 17 states that provide no compensation for people exonerated of crimes. The legislation would generally permit a person who is convicted of a crime he or she did not commit and later is exonerated to receive $50,000 for each year they were wrongfully incarcerated. To receive the money, individuals would have to dismiss any existing civil lawsuit or agree not to sue the state, a local government, or any public official or employee.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Former U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly is joining a Washington, D.C. lobbying firm. Akin Gump announced Wednesday that the Democrat would be a partner in his public law and policy group starting next month. He will advise clients in the financial services, defense, and healthcare industries. Donnelly represented the South Bend area in the U.S. House for 6 years before winning election to the Senate in 2012. He lost his re-election bid to Republican Mike Braun in November. Donnelly cited Akin Gump's bipartisan team in a statement and said, quote, joining the firm was an easy decision. A spokesperson for the firm says Donnelly will teach classes at the University of Notre Dame and live in Indiana. Donnelly is leading 2 one-credit courses at the school this semester.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Across much of the Midwest, maternal and infant death rates are high, especially among African Americans. So doctors, public health agencies, and nonprofit organizations are searching for solutions. Among them is Sistering CU in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. It offers free home visits from trained volunteers to families with babies up to 6 months in age. It also recently launched a support group for new parents. Co-founder Erin Murphy spoke with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman about a new initiative to promote safe sleep habits and support families.
We target families who have just had a baby, whether that's through adoption or, you know, delivered the baby themselves. So our programs focus on sending a volunteer, matching a volunteer to go to their home for 2 hours a week for 12 visits to help them as they recover and transition to becoming a mom and becoming a dad and getting used to having a family life. And it takes help to do that, we believe so.
Yeah. You guys have a new grant-funded effort that you are doing right now involving baby boxes. So can you tell me a little bit about what baby boxes are and what purpose they serve?
Yes. So baby boxes are an idea that was developed first in Finland and like in the 1930s. And today, every single family in Finland gets a baby box. And the box, first of all, serves a double purpose. It holds like diapers, bottles, things that you might need for bringing home a new baby. But the box itself is also a safe place for the baby to sleep.
So like a bassinet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you can move it from room to room because it's a box. It's a cardboard box. But inside there is a mattress and some sheets. So it's a comfortable, lightweight, safe place for the baby to go from room to room or to sleep next, you know, like on the floor next to you. And it's shown to reduce rates of SIDS for families that don't have a place that's safe for baby to sleep.
And I learned that even in Virginia, they give these boxes to all new families across the state.
In Virginia, everyone in that whole state will be getting a baby box. And there are some other states like that. New Jersey also, I think, does it. And Louisiana had a program as well. And it has shown in those states to reduce rates of SIDS when they went out.
Yeah, that sudden infant death syndrome.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when we heard about this idea, we were so inspired because it's like both a practical, useful tool for the family and also a symbol of support. Like what you're doing is really important. What it really matters. It's good for the community, for you to be healthy, for your family to be healthy. And so we're just thrilled to be able to start the program. At least, you know, 50 boxes is a small start, but it's a start.
And you also recently started a new parent support group.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes. So we bring one of our volunteers in, and we have a little space for the babies to kind of lay down on the ground, some toys there. So they're right in the room with us. And we just talk about the highs, the lows.
And the in-betweens.
And the in-between, yeah. You know, like, and share tips, like what worked for you for sleeping, what didn't work for you. My baby doesn't sleep. And the truth is some babies just don't sleep. And that's okay, and we can talk about it. And it doesn't mean you're a bad mom or dad that you can't get your baby to take two-hour naps.
Is there anything else you would like to share?
We are recruiting families. I think one of the hardest things is to know that it's normal to need help and to want help at the beginning, and we don't have to do it all on our own. So we're trying to really change the expectations that we can do this, we should do this. In fact, it takes a village, and we have lost our villages around us when we live in a transient community. We're far away from grandparents or our close friends and neighbors who would have helped us, and we want to be that village. We just want to be there and support you because we do believe what you're doing is really important. We believe you're important. So we just want to be there to support you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The painkiller fentanyl is getting a lot of attention lately. It's often used in illegal street drugs, and experts say it's to blame for skyrocketing overdose deaths. Now, a series of deaths at an Ohio hospital is raising questions about oversight in prescribing fentanyl. Side Effects Public Media's Paige Flager reports.
Ohio is at the heart of the nation's opioid crisis, and nearly three-fourths of overdose deaths here are due to fentanyl. But at Mount Carmel, one of Central Ohio's largest health systems, fentanyl has made headlines in a new way. Mount Carmel says Dr. William Husel was fired after ordering, quote, significantly excessive and potentially fatal doses of fentanyl. The overdoses began in 2014 and involved dozens of patients. In a video released by the hospital, CEO Ed Lamb apologized.
Following our discovery, we addressed related patient safety issues. We removed this doctor from all patient care and terminated his employment.
Originally, Mount Carmel said all the patients were near death, but its investigation later revealed that five patients could have improved. That included 44-year-old Troy Allison. His wife, Christine, called an ambulance in July 2018 because he was having trouble breathing.
I really expected to go to the hospital. They would, you know, make him better. We would be home that night and go on with our lives. And that didn't happen. That didn't happen at all.
Within a few hours of arriving at Mount Carmel, Troy Allison was dead. He was given a 1,000 microgram dose of fentanyl ordered by Husel.
We'd been married 11 years, but we had been together 18 years. And he wasn't just my husband, he was my best friend.
Christine Allison is one of more than 20 families who have sued Husel, the hospital, and nurses and pharmacists. The doses in these cases range from 200 to 2,000 micrograms. The proper dosage for such a powerful painkiller varies. It can depend on weight or a tolerance to opioids, or if a patient is close to death and not expected to recover. Arthur Kaplan is a medical ethicist at New York University.
The whole area of how much pain medicine to give, how to manage someone who you're going to allow to die is very gray.
Some hospital workers say they questioned Husel about the amount of fentanyl he was prescribing, but his explanations seemed reasonable, and he denies that he intentionally gave a fatal overdose.
There's not like clear-cut rules, clear-cut standards about what to do. So challenging, asking questions, that's very appropriate. But if you get answers that you think make sense, that's certainly common and would be happening at many hospitals.
Researchers have found other problems with fentanyl. Caleb Alexander of Johns Hopkins University recently completed a study on a very potent type of fentanyl used for cancer patients. He found that as many as half of patients should never have been prescribed the drug in the first place.
the harm that comes from opioids is not inherent in the product. It's all about how the product is being used. And what we've seen is that far too often in the past two decades, doctors and patients have used opioids in settings where they have an unfavorable risk-benefit balance.
His views are in line with guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that call for a numerical cap on opioid use. But this month, 300 healthcare experts told the CDC those guidelines hurt patients with chronic pain. They say pharmacies are erecting obstacles to obtaining drugs, and doctors who want to prescribe more risk being disciplined.
And unfortunately, when cases like this one in Columbus come up, it has a chilling effect.
Michael Schottman is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Pain Research.
To me, this whole notion of regulators deciding, you know, whether they be on an external level or within the hospital, deciding how much they can prescribe is absurd.
Administrators at Mount Carmel recently did just that. New guidelines limit the availability of opioids in automated medication dispensing systems, and a strict monitoring system tracks prescriptions of high doses. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. No matter where you live in the country, many people have an opinion on the proposed border wall. But how do the people who live in the southern part of Texas feel about it? Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson produced this Man on the Street type piece. She went to gas stations, recreation halls, and even a museum in several towns in South Texas and got the locals' opinions on the proposed border wall.
In Gulfview Estates, a 55 and over retirement community in Mission, Texas, there's people from all over the United States and Canada who live down there, most of them for only part of the year. They are called winter Texans. Others, a minority amount, live there year-round. Lakeshore Public Radio traveled to the southernmost part of Texas to get their opinions on the barrier wall that would go between Texas and Mexico. We asked John Meadows from Des Moines, Iowa.
What's your opinion on the border wall? Should there be one? Why or why not?
My opinion of the border wall is we can get along without it. We just need a little more people with authority to have a little better knowledge than they got. I know what my good friends are. They watch Fox News, so I got to be careful what I say.
Well, no, you can say whatever you want.
I want to maintain my friendship with them.
All right.
I value their friendship.
And so I then turn to the friend standing next to John Meadows, Jim Jackson, who lives part of the year in Mission and the other part in Oregon, Illinois.
Why don't you give me your opinion of the border wall?
I'm really not thinking about the border wall, but if anything will help, I'm sure. It's expensive, but we give other countries lots of money, so instead of giving it to them, fix our own country first.
Joyce Golden is from Cudahy, Wisconsin, a suburb of Milwaukee. Golden was in Mission visiting family.
You used to be a police officer.
Correct.
A deputy sheriff, Milwaukee County deputy sheriff. So can you give me your opinion of the border wall? Should we have one? Why or why not?
Well, I actually had an opportunity to see it, and I personally think that, yes, it's going to be something that we need. And it seems that the locals are wanting it. It was interesting on a tour boat ride that we took on the Rio Grande that only 2% of the people, like out of every 10 people they arrest, only 2 are of Mexican descent. The rest are from other countries, China, Honduras, all different other countries. So there's really, I think, a misperception that they're all Mexicans, and it's not. So I think it is something we need, and it's only a part of what we need. There needs to be a bunch of different systems. They have blimps. They have the Border Patrol, they have Border Patrol on horses, they have drones, and all those things together are necessary. Because just a wall isn't going to be the cure-all, so to speak. We had an opportunity to go to a pull ferry. It's the only one left in the United States. And we had the opportunity to talk to a customs when we came. Because we went across the river, which is Mexico, so when you came back, you had to show your passport. And so it wasn't busy. We had an opportunity to talk to her, and she's been doing this for 22 years. And she actually claimed we were talking in a light manner about tunnels. And she says, oh, yeah. They have tunnels. She says, places, even they found one underneath the river already, you know. But those just show that you need multiple ways of border patrol. A wall is not the cure-all, but I think it would be effective in many of the situations. But you still need the horses, you still need the cars patrolling, you need the blimp and the cameras and all that. So, yes, I'm for the wall.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We then turn to Golden's sister, Phyllis McGrory, from Waterford, Wisconsin.
I know it's a very divided subject. I'm having friends at home that think we absolutely, positively have to have that wall, and then other friends that are saying that we don't need to be spending the money on that. Those people are going to find a way to get in here with a wall or without a wall. There's a lot of sadness here about the wall because it's dividing a national park that houses birds and butterflies. And there's a church that it's involving and other businesses in another park. So a lot of people around the country don't realize that. So it is a very divided subject.
What was the name of the park?
Benson National Park. I'm not sure if that's the correct total name, but it's Benson National Park. And then there is the Butterfly Park. And then I think Benson Park is the one that has the birding. People come from all over the world to do the birding and the butterflying. So it's going to take a lot of property away from both of those.
Can you give me your first and last name? Your first name?
Not really.
No? Okay, well, that's
all right.
I'll
answer your questions.
Okay, the question is, do we need a border wall, and why or why not, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, border walls, I honestly don't even have an opinion on that. I don't see a problem in it, and I don't see a problem against it.
Okay.
It can be seen as we need one, and it can be seen as we don't need one, but really, in my opinion, I honestly have never looked into it. So, honestly, I can't really give an opinion for that since I have never really looked into the problems or anything wrong with it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
No problem.
Where are you from?
I'm from Harlingen. I recently moved over here to Alamo, so really not that far.
Nellie Garcia from Palmview, Texas in the Rio Grande Valley has lived in the area all her life. She said, if anything, the wall will bring people jobs. We got her perspective.
Do you think that there should be a border wall? Why or why not? Do you think one's needed?
My family is directly across this river. My Mexican family is directly across. There is a lot of violence on the other side of our river. Very bad violence going on. But it's a drug fight. It's a territory fight for drugs. But that's on that side of the river. My personal opinion about the wall is if we build it, there's going to be a lot of jobs. And then a new president will come in and we'll drop it and there's going to be a lot of jobs. So in my end of it, I don't care for a wall or no wall. It's a lifestyle here. We cross the border. I go to Mexico and I come back. I go to Miguel Alemán. I go to Reynosa. I cross the border very often. But I see it as a job opportunity for a lot of people here, to be honest.
And how long have you lived out here?
My whole life, 37 years.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Lake County Public Library Executive Director and CEO Ingrid Norris.
The concern, I think, is probably one that is more of an education probably to the average citizen and the average taxpayer as to really what do public libraries financially live on as far as the rest of the pie is concerned, and how in turn this particular bill would make some big changes if it should happen to become enacted into law. Tell us a little bit about without getting too wonkish, I suppose, about the structure of how the financing for public library systems happens in Indiana.
Okay, currently, the Department of Local Government, we submit a budget. They tell us what we're allowed to levy the taxpayers for, and on average, in Indiana, we get about 4 cents for every dollar that is collected. Most of the money goes to school and county and city government. So we advertise our budget to the public. public have a chance to come in and give us their opinion on that. We cannot go higher than what, if we go higher than the Department of Local Government tells us, we actually do have to go with what's called binding review, which means our fiscal bodies, such as the county, would approve or disapprove whether we have the ability to increase our budget. Mm-hmm. So what this bill would do is say that all budgets that we submit would have to go through either the county or the city. So, for example, Hammond would go through the Hammond City Council. So with the tax caps and the circuit breaker, that's a little unnerving because of the fact that everybody's scrambling for money.
That's right. I mean, we know we've talked before and had conversations before talking about the problems that the public school districts in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular are going to face when the tax caps pop off in 2020 and try to figure out how are we going to survive with a reduced amount coming in from property taxes. To be sure, it's not going to be any easier for the public library districts either, is it?
That's correct. And in fact, public libraries are getting hit even at a greater rate with the circuit breakers than any other government agency. There's been some studies that show that public libraries are going to have even more of it, have a bigger impact with the tax caps than the schools or the towns or the county government. So.
Now, there is a difference that maybe most people don't recognize or be even aware of in how the tax levies are set up for public libraries and with other units of local government. So we're talking about towns and cities and county government too. What is the basic difference between the two? How do libraries and how they work differ from just your average city governments, we'll say?
Well, the public library is not allowed to levy for, say, a capital improvements money. So the libraries have both a rainy day fund and then they have a library improvement reserve fund. We are, to be able to fund those, we actually have to be frugal and mm-hmm. we have to, at the end of the year, whatever money we are able to transfer that money to one of these two funds. Then if we need to, for example, I have 9 buildings, so there's HVAC systems, there's repairs. That money comes from the money that we have saved over the years to fund those. Every other government entity, schools, county, police departments, you know, all of those entities have a CUME fund, which means they can actually levy taxpayers or assess taxpayers' money to be able to fund those. We have to, in general, have to be frugal so that we can save basically for rainy days.
Now, going back in time, when the Lake County Public Library System decided that they needed to expand the Central Library in Merrillville and add on the space, there were just not enough shelves, space for all the books and other items that were there, and do some shifting around. How did that major project get funded?
We actually went out for a bond and went through the whole legal process, and we received a $30 million bond, and we built new buildings, we renovated all the other buildings, and actually we, because of the tax caps, we refinanced that bond so that we could pay off early the bond, so it wouldn't, when the tax caps in Lake County take effect, Lake County Library will only have one more bond payment in 2020.
Wow.
We specifically did that so that, because we knew that was going to come under the tax caps, and so we felt it was fiscally responsible for us to do. So we double paid the bond a couple of years, and then we also refinanced to a lower rate. So that is because of Larry HF, our former director, that he realized, he looked to the future and decided it was the best. So our bond is actually going to be falling away in 2020, and that's because of the work that we did.
Now, how do you think the Lake County Public Library System fares in that respect compared maybe to others around the state in other cities like Fort Wayne or South Bend or Indianapolis even, with maybe the same kind of debt load that they're going to have to deal with?
Well, actually, for us, we don't know how it's going to fare because we overlap 41 other entities. So all the debt that is with those other entities will impact our budget because with the tax caps, there's only so much money. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know how we're going to be. we think we may lose $1 million in our budget just because of all the other debt that is still out there in Lake County. So all we just have to wait till 2020 and see.
And find out. And that's unfortunately, that puts you, I guess, in the same boat as the towns and the cities, the townships in particular, and all the public school districts out there, too. They're waiting to find out what impact the dropping of the circuit breaker for Lake County is going to have here now. In looking at this measure, and we should mention, too, that if you want to look it up and find out more, the bill probably itself doesn't tell you much, but the bill is entitled House Bill 1343. And it is now, as we said, it's in the Senate. It's made it over to the Senate. In fact, the Senate Local Government Committee had the hearing last Thursday in Indianapolis that you and a number of your colleagues attended to talk to the lawmakers on committee about. With this intent of trying to find a way to restructure library budgets so that they would come under the supervision, however you want to put it, of a town or city or a county council, do you think that maybe there are some library districts or library operations elsewhere in the state that might be in worse shape, and in turn they were the ones that might be that was the intent of the people that are drafting the measure to bring them under control?
Well, I think there is a little bit of a misunderstanding, because the library that actually triggered it did have a cash reserve, and so they specifically lowered the amount of money they were collecting from the taxpayers to pay down that or to use the reserve. And once they had brought it down to a reasonable level, they went back to their allowed tax levy. So if you look at, you know, the what it looks like on the internet or on Gateway, which is the thing, it appears like they dramatically increased their budget. They didn't. They just went back to their original, what they were allowed. So, but there are other libraries. I think I have a good relationship. We have a good relationship with county government. I think the other libraries are concerned because there's an inherent bias that the ones that could profit from reducing a library budget, because they would obviously get more money, they're going to be the ones that will be able to decide. And the way it's written now is up to 10% a year annually. In 10 years, we could be at 25% of our budget.
So there are concerns, and maybe not necessarily in Lake County's case, but some county out there with a very ambitious city council or county council will take a look at this paperwork, see how the budget is structured, and they'll sit and kind of smack their lips, especially if they see a big number in that reserve fund in particular. But there may have been a reason for that particular library system to put that, make sure that number is in there, because they've got some big work that'll have to be done eventually. And because we've done all of our big work earlier, we don't have that much problem to worry about these days now.
I think that's a good synopsis of the problem that, you know, like I said, we're doing fine in Lake County. Our board is engaged. I think part of the problem is, too, is they believe that because it's an appointed board, they shouldn't have the authority to levy or ask for taxpayer money. But I think that's a slippery slope, because there are other appointed boards that manage money. And if you go down this path, then economic development board, you know, there's other appointed boards that could be at risk if this bill goes through, because it's appointed boards. There's a reason for appointed boards.
Do you think that in this case in particular, and having a chance to talk with your colleagues in particular here in Lake County, of course, Renee Greenleaf is the executive director of the Hammond Public Library, and she's expressed some very real concerns about the fact that maybe if this bill becomes law, that particular councils, whether in this case in Hammond, the city council, may want to be able to use some of that reserve money that in turn she's been trying to hang on to, because she may, like you say, it may be a case where the heating and ventilation air conditioning system needs to be replaced, and you can't take that out of the tax dollars. You got to find other ways to pay for it.
I think that's a real concern across the state, because when a county reaches the tax cap, the taxpayers basically, it's redistributing the pie. So rather than getting 4 cents to the dollar, what they're doing is putting that money back into the tax circuit breaker fund, and it basically would relieve the stress on other agencies. So whether they wouldn't really be able to take the money, but they would be able to put it back in the pie and be able to redistribute to, you know, the county and the schools would have the biggest. But again, when you only get 4 cents to the dollar, putting that money back in the pie is like putting salt in the ocean. It's not, it would have a dramatic impact on a library, but the other agencies, it wouldn't even move the dial for them. So I think it's kind of, you know, when you're so small to begin with, libraries are not going to solve the circuit breaker issue. Our money isn't going to have much impact. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that in this case, if you're looking statewide here, because there are concerns about library systems that are having problems or could have problems if they're not careful in the future, that this need to be able to take over control financially is something that has libraries worried, and in particular, libraries that, like I said, are kind of looking over their shoulder, not only looking at who's going to take over them as far as the money's concerned, but also, too, to help get the services done.
I think right now we have the law is in place that the county government can, if right now we have libraries that as they come together as a town and say, okay, we're hitting the circuit breaker, and they all work together between schools, towns, and talk about how are we going to deal with it. If for whatever reason a library decided to go and decide, you know what, we're going to do what we're going to do, there's a mechanism in place, because county government, for example, at Lake County, 4 of our appointed board members are from the county. Mm-hmm. So if the county says, you know what, you need to reduce your budget, and because we're all doing it, if we said, nah, you know what, we're just going to go off on our own, they have 4 appointees that they could just say, you know what, it's in the law, we can reappoint different people that are willing to play ball and that are willing to listen to reason. So there is a mechanism in place, and it has been used with other libraries. So I think the mechanism is in place because they appoint our we have 4 from the county and 3 from school boards, and other libraries have had their appointees reappointed if they weren't happy with the way they were engaging with their counties. So I think the law is in place, and that's kind of what I testified when I testified in Indianapolis. There's already a law to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of collateral damage if you try and fix one problem and then actually break the system.
Well, now that this bill has come at least through hearing, it's still in the Senate and has yet to come up before the full Senate for consideration. House Bill 1343 has been, I guess, judged by some as that, at least in its current form, is not workable enough to maybe to get passage or maybe even to come up for a vote. Even though you're a librarian and not a legislative specialist, do you think that's the impression that you and your colleagues get, that this bill maybe this year might be dead, and at least it's going to have to be really, really seriously reworked before it comes back up?
Yeah, I think that's the impression I got from the committee meeting, is that the way it reads now, which is that the county or the city could ask for binding review or supervision, mm-hmm, of the thing, and there was enough holes in it that I think there are enough legislators said there's too many holes, there's too many gaps in the bill. So I would say that we're watching it, that we're not going to believe that it's dead. And if it comes back up for testimony, there will be librarians that will go back and testify. So we're hopeful, but we're not. But we're still going to watch how it's tracking.
Well, there's still about at least a month left in the General Assembly session till the end of April. The budget for the next 2 years is still working its way through the individual houses that got out of the House. It's now over in the Senate, being looked at, or will be, I'm sure, very soon. So that there'll be opportunities, except if it's not going to get changed this time, that maybe this could still come alive in 2020, I suppose, which would just be unfortunate for us here in Lake County, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, with the perfect storm, 2020 in Lake County. Yeah.
Well, Ingrid, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about this, explaining what the general financial situation not only is for the Lake County Public Library System, but how public libraries in Indiana get their money and how they have to keep track of it, and how having a specific bill become law ordering that the general, I guess you could say, of financial bodies, the fiscal bodies, I guess is the word I'm looking for. In this case, talking about town councils, city councils, county councils, they're responsible for money within their own particular local jurisdictions, but how they take on library system on top of that, it'll be interesting to see what does come about here. Thank you for spending time with us to go over this and try to get the rally the troops together to get people who are supportive of the not only the Lake County Public Library System, but all the others here in Lake County and the region to be ready for something that may come out from this. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Ingrid Norris is the Executive Director and CEO of the Lake County Public Library.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.